Let's turn this morning to Daniel chapter 6, where we get a glimpse at Daniel now in his latter years in life. I have a 9-year-old son at home who often reminds me of the power of a promise. He phrases things just right. "Dad, when are we going to go camping this year? Like you promised." "Dad, when are you going to teach me how to play golf? Remember, you promised." And he often reminds me with statements like that, that a person, when he makes a promise, should stand behind it. A person should be one of his word. A promise is a holy thing, whether you make it to a chairman of the board or you make it to a child. And so today we're going to look at Daniel, a man who kept his promises throughout his entire life. He was faithful. Faithful means to be true to your word, to keep what you say you're going to do. The official banner for the Marine Corps on their bumper stickers and their motto is Semper Fidelis, always faithful. Yet, in the book of Proverbs, chapter 20, the writer asks this question. It says, "Most men will proclaim each his own goodness, but who can find a faithful man?" That is a good question. And it's an interesting statement. People will say, "Well, you know, I'm not as bad as other people, and I'm as good as the next." They'll proclaim their own goodness, but who can find a truly faithful man? And that's a good question in a day and age in which we live, where we have shady politicians and, in many cases, shady religious leaders and fallen sports heroes. And as we look around the country, we ask that same question that Solomon asked. Who can find a faithful man? The thing about Daniel is that he was faithful publicly as well as privately. He had reputation and he had character. He was faithful when everybody was looking, and he was faithful to his God when nobody was looking. And it's rare to find somebody who has that balance of public and private integrity that is kept as a string all the way through his life. We've all known people who've made confessions of Jesus Christ, and outwardly they may appear very righteous, and yet after a while we see them become casualties in the race of life. They're not there any longer serving the Lord. Daniel, in this chapter, is about 86 years old. We saw him in chapter 1 when he was about 15 years old, and a few dynasties have come and gone since then. We'll look at that in a minute. But he's quite a bit older here. And he's about to leave a legacy behind for the Babylonians. What would it be like if you could read your own obituary? It'd be a strange experience, wouldn't it? You know, there was a guy named Alfred Nobel who picked up the newspaper one morning, opened it up, and read that he had died. Of course, he was astonished to read this, sort of like Mark Twain is greatly exaggerated where the talks of his death. But he read that he was noted for the one who discovered dynamite. And it sort of struck him. He thought, you know, I don't want to leave that as what people will remember me for, such a destructive kind of an invention. And so after reading that and informing the paper that they had made a mistake, he went on to develop what was called the Nobel Peace Prize, which would be awarded to people who would make achievements in making world peace. It was reading his obituary that caused that to happen. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 7, "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death is better than the day of one's birth." In other words, we will leave this world making some statement to the world of what we represented, of what we were all about. That's why Solomon said the day of one's death is better, because there's a life now that has been lived that can be passed on as a legacy and as a message. Now, Babylon in chapter 6 is under new management. Nebuchadnezzar is long gone. His grandson in chapter 5, Belshazzar, is also long gone. In fact, a whole nother country is in control. The Medo-Persians have taken over, and Darius the Mede is sort of the big cheese in charge of Babylon now. Cyrus gave him the dominion over Babylon, and so Darius the Mede becomes the de facto king of this city. Daniel has seen emperors come and go, and yet we're going to see him emerge to a place of prominence once again, as we saw in chapter 1. Let's read the first 11 verses together, and then we'll go back over it. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So the governors and the satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. And then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and the advisors, have consulted together to establish a royal statute, to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter." Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Daniel never lost his edge from the time he started at 15 till this time as an older gentleman. He is faithful through and through. In fact, that's what I've sort of titled this message, Faithful Through and Through. We find four ways in which Daniel exhibited faithfulness throughout his life. Number one, he was faithful consistently. It was not sporadic. We saw him as a 15-year-old in chapter 1. Now he's pushing 90. They think he's about 86 years old as you open up chapter 6. He's faithful consistently. Wherever we see him appear in this book, he's a person who is always rising to the top, the cream of the crop, faithful, and a person that you can count on throughout his life. When you think of somebody being 90 years old, you might think, well, I would say that's about retirement age. After all, you know, you've done it all, you've seen it all, you've raised children, grandchildren, by that age, great-grandchildren, it's time to just tell them about the good old days. But as far as active involvement, well, that's long gone, long past. But not Daniel. Daniel's pushing 90, but he's still being used by God powerfully. He's sort of like the spiritual version of the Ever Ready Bunny. You know that commercial? Just keeps going and going and going and going. And we don't see Daniel fading off into retirement, but very actively involved in the kingdom in Babylon. Don't think that age means sitting on the sideline. In fact, as we read the Bible, there are several examples of people, notable people, who come of age as they grow into age. They come of age spiritually, and they make a great impact on people the older they get. I remember when I was much younger, when I was a teenager, I'd talk to my friends, and there was sort of a saying back then, you can't trust anybody over 30. You know, I don't know. We don't know if they're really thinking like we're thinking and have our best interests at heart. We can't trust them. Of course, now that I'm 40, I look back and I think, I wonder if you can trust anybody under 30 these days. Somebody said you can tell you're getting older when all of the names in your little black book end in MD. It's a good sign that you're getting older. Somebody else said, you know you're getting older when you get winded playing chess and you look forward to a dull evening. He said, you know you're getting older when your knees buckle and your belt won't buckle. You know you're getting older when you're 17 around the neck, 42 around the waist, and 126 around the golf course. He said, you know you're getting older when you sink your teeth into a steak and they stay there. Well, age is often an attitude. I was reading a magazine on the plane toward North Carolina the other day, and it had this guy who was probably in his 60s or late 60s, early 70s, and they were giving his profile, his hobbies, things that he likes to do, his career, and they came to his age, and it said, state of mind. Age is a state of mind. And I think age really is an attitude. You are as young as your faith. You are as old as your pessimism and your doubt. And Daniel seems to be ever young in his attitude and his actions in the kingdom of Babylon. A few years back, I ate lunch with a 95-year-old missionary. He reminded me of Daniel, 95, and he was going back out on the mission field. He was just home on furlough. And his name was George Simmons. He was 95, and the muscles around his mouth had given way a little bit, and he would drool from time to time, and he was aware of it. He said, look, I'm 95, and the plumbing leaks a little bit, but I'm okay. My legs, he said, don't know that I'm 95, and I plan to go out on the mission field here in another couple weeks. He just was like Daniel. He kept going and going and going in the service of the Lord. Oftentimes, people get to this age of Daniel in chapter 6 and feelings of guilt or uselessness set in. Oh, I wish I could have done things differently, or I wish I could have really been used by God. But not Daniel. He always looked ahead. He was used as a younger man and then used as an older man. And Daniel's not the only one. Here's a few examples for you. William Gladstone, for the fourth time, became Prime Minister of England when he was 83 years old. Thomas Edison was still inventing when he was 90. Frank Lloyd Wright, at 90, was considered still a most creative architect. J.C. Penney, a great Christian man, kept office hours at 95. Michelangelo, when he was 89, painted perhaps his greatest painting, The Last Judgment, which is still in the Sistine Chapel. John Wesley, 88 years old, still preached eloquently after riding on horseback for over 250,000 miles, writing volumes of books and preaching 4,000 sermons. After that, he's 88, he's still going strong preaching the gospel. Some of you may know Roy Gustafson. He's spoken here at the Cove several times. Roy is, I think, around 80 years old. Somewhere around there, and he had bypass surgery, phlebitis surgery. I called him in his hospital room after he had surgery, and I didn't know how he was doing. Donna Tony, Franklin's secretary, called and said, he's in the hospital, he had phlebitis surgery, had a bypass, and so I called him up, and he got on the phone, and he said, I'm going to Africa next Thursday. I said, Roy, boy, I don't know if you ought to go. No, I'm going to go. He just keeps going and shares the gospel wherever he goes. And then we think of Dr. Graham, 77, still doing crusades, going to Sacramento here in a few weeks, was last spring in Puerto Rico. And not only is he still going, but the spectrum of his impact just seems to grow. He reaches more people as the years go on. And we saw in the video last night that man from Australia who said, I think only Billy Graham could do this. He's got the name that people trust, a reputation that when they hear the Graham name, there is that integrity and faithfulness behind it that people still trust. Another example from the scripture is a guy named Caleb. The reason I've always loved Caleb is his attitude at whatever age you find him. When he was a younger man, he was the guy who was one of the 12 spies that Moses sent out into the land of Canaan, and he brought back a good report. 10 of them brought back an evil report. The 10 of them said, there's giants in the land. We can't conquer it. We are small in their sight, and they are huge in our sight. But it was Joshua and Caleb who said, oh, come on, God gave us a promise. Easy pickings, let's go for it. Well, they didn't go. They wandered in disbelief. But it was Caleb who, when they finally reached the promised land, and there in the distance was the hill of Hebron, Caleb was 85 years young when he came to Joshua. And he said these words, I am as strong this day as on the day that Moses sent me. Just as my strength was then, so now is my strength for war. Imagine an 85-year-old saying, come on, let's fight them. Let's get them. For war, both for going out and coming in. Daniel, like Caleb and others, was not living in the past. He didn't look to past glories. He wasn't satisfied with what happened one time back then. So many people live their life in the past tense. Oh, yes, I remember back in 19, whatever it was, I made a commitment to Jesus Christ, and what a glorious time it was. Actually, past experiences are not valid unless they're translated into the present tense. What they motivate us to do now. Like Caleb said, just like it was back then, so it is even now, both for going out and for coming in. Daniel had a consistent relationship with God. He made a commitment when he was young. He followed through on that commitment when now he was 86 years old. I read a little article in a Nashville newspaper, just a little editorial. It was about a woman named Lila Craig, who has not missed attending church. She's 88 years old, and she's there every Sunday. And the newspaper remarked that she never misses a Sunday. And the editor said in this newspaper, it makes one wonder, just what is the matter with Mrs. Craig? I would answer that editor and say, nothing at all, Mr. Editor, is wrong with that woman. Everything's right. She's faithful consistently, and so is Daniel. Now, let's look at the next couple verses, verse 2 and 3. We see that Daniel was not only faithful throughout his life, but in particular, he was faithful professionally in the workforce. And over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors, the satraps, because an excellent spirit was in him. The king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Once again, Daniel is in government position, government authority. And it seems that no matter what kingdom we find him in, whether it's Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, Belshazzar's kingdom, or now Darius the Mede's kingdom, these guys always see the qualities in Daniel and raise him up to a higher level professionally. They make him a leader. If you would go back with me to chapter 5 and look back at verse 29, it says, then Belshazzar, he's the guy in Babylon before the Medo-Persians, Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple, put a chain of gold around his neck, made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now let's go back to the beginning when he was much younger in Daniel chapter 2, and let's look at another verse. Verse 46, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. And the king answered Daniel and said, truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Well, here again, he's up to bat. And King Darius puts him as one of the three administrative assistants, then it's sort of like a joint chief of staff over Babylon, over his kingdom. Jesus said, you are the light of the world. He went on to say, a city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but they put it on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. One of the best places I know to do that is on the job. Because the place we spend most of our time next to our family is our job. It's the workplace. The family is the preparation place, but the stage of life is the workplace. So it's incumbent upon us to be faithful in the professional realm. The average person, if we live to be an average of 70 years old, hopefully by God's grace we exceed that. They say that if we live to be 70, that 20 years of our life will be spent sleeping cumulatively. 20 years of our life will be spent working. I know sometimes we feel like we put in 20 years in about a week. But 20 years of our life will be spent working. 6 years of our life will be spent eating. Now, I know that varies from person to person. 5 years of our life will be spent getting dressed, and again, that varies from person to person. And a couple years is spent on the telephone. But 20 years of our life is spent working. Man, 20 years of being able to give a testimony in the professional realm, on the stage of life. You see, when people find out that a Christian is working on their job, automatically, if they're an unbeliever, they have certain questions that go through their mind. They go, oh, a Christian. Well, what's so different about a Christian? How do Christians come to work on Monday morning? I'll watch and see. What kind of business ethics do Christians carry to the workplace? I'll watch and see. How do Christians react under pressure? What do they say that is different from what I say under pressure? I'll watch, I'll listen, and I'll see. I think some of my best years of ministry were in the secular workforce. Before I was in the ministry, my background was in radiology and computerized CAT scans and nuclear medicine. And some of the greatest opportunities I had were sharing the gospel in a work setting by my lifestyle with people who would never come to church otherwise. The church had to come to them. In fact, I remember I was going through the x-ray department one time, and a person knew I was a Christian and heard me share the gospel, and she said, well, do you ever think you'll get into full-time ministry? I said, I am in full-time ministry, right here. Wherever we are as Christians, we are in full-time ministry. You see, witnessing is not something you do. It is something you are. Jesus said, and you shall be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth. He didn't say, and you will go witnessing in Jerusalem and Judea. You are a witness. All of us, if we are a believer, are a witness for Jesus Christ. The question is, are we a good witness for Jesus Christ? Are we a faithful witness in the work and the professional realm? Well, Daniel was on the job, and he gave his testimony. How did he do it? Well, it wasn't by passing out tracts. It was by being good at what he did, number one. By working hard. When I was working at St. Joseph Hospital in Orange County, California, and CHOC, Children's Hospital, and St. Joe's Hospital together, I was a believer, and there was a young believer that worked in the x-ray department. He was an orderly and very zealous. And I remember we would tell him, you know, go get a patient up in this room. We have an exam to do on him. And he would take 45 minutes. And we would wait for the patient, and the schedule was getting booked up. And I drew him aside, and I said, Jay, what seems to be the problem? We ask you to get patients, and we ask you to do your job, and you're taking longer than most people. He said, oh, brother, I'm preaching the gospel. When I go up to their room and I get to, you know, put the gurney outside the room and I sit down on their bed and I share with them, isn't that exciting? I said, no, it's not exciting. I said, if you want to share the gospel with them, and you should, do it on your break, do it after work, and do it at lunch. But while you're called to be working for these people, do your job the best you can so that people think, Christians are the best workers that I have working for me. That's the testimony you ought to leave. You ought to be the best orderly in this place and bring the patients down promptly and share the gospel with them, but do it in such a manner that it doesn't take away from your job. William Stover runs a business in San Francisco, California. He's a Christian, and he supplies temporary workers for businesses. He said, quote, "Witnessing should be natural, an integral part of a person's character, and a person's business practices have to match what he preaches, or else no one's going to listen to his message. The business ethic must match what we say with our lips." Well, Daniel did that in every kingdom he was at. He worked hard. He had wisdom, and God gave him favor with the emperors. Look also now in verse 3. This Daniel distinguished himself above the governors. That is an Aramaic, that's what it's written in, Aramaic participle that speaks of a continual process. He regularly distinguished himself. Or you might say, he was in the habit of distinguishing himself above all of the rest. Notice how the same text says, because an excellent spirit was in him. Or you might call it an extraordinary attitude. He had a good work ethic, but he had a great attitude that he worked with. And it got the king's attention, and the king said, hey, give this guy a raise. Let's turn to our New Testaments for just a moment, to the book of Ephesians, and let's see this principle sort of fleshed out in Paul's writings, Ephesians chapter 5, where Paul basically says, work hard and have a good attitude. I'm sorry, Ephesians chapter 6. Did I say 5? It's Ephesians 6. Verse 5. Bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and sincerity of heart as to Christ, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will, doing service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is slave or free. And you masters do the same things to them, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master also is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. The early church saw their position, whether slave or free, to be used as a witnessing tool. In other words, the slaves were told, don't rebel, but be the best possible slave you can. And did you know that Christian slaves brought the highest money in the Roman slave markets? Because overall they had a better attitude and they did their job with more fervor. Notice in verse 6 how we're to do this. Not just when the boss is watching. It says, not with eye service. I can remember in high school in my gym class, we had to do a lot of sit-ups, and Coach Zipkovich, that was his name, would always come around the corner sort of like a police officer and look at how we were doing our sit-ups. And basically, I wouldn't do them at all until he came around the corner. And as soon as he came around the corner, I'd go, oh, yeah, boy, this is hard. And then he'd walk away, and I'd just lay back down again. Well, that's not how a Christian is supposed to do his work. Or when the boss is coming, you know, we furrow our brow and put the pencil up like we're thinking about some hard equation. He walks off and we pick up the magazine again. The idea here is not with eye service, not just when somebody is looking. But notice, for the right reason, it says, as to Christ, as to the Lord, and not to men. Our real boss is God. It is not us if we own our own practice or our own business. God is our boss, and God is always watching us. He's always concerned with what we do and how we do what we do. And I think that Christians would have a whole new experience of purpose if they would walk to work Monday morning with this attitude. Their attitude would be, God is my boss, and I'm going to do my work to please the Lord. I'm going to do it for Him as an offering to God. I think it would change the way we work. And it would change the reason that we work. It would become a meaningful ministry to us instead of just drudgery, instead of just another thing that we perform. There's a story about a band of minstrels who lived in a far country. They lived in Europe. And it was during the days when they would go from town to town as little bands of performing minstrels and put on performances. They would sell tickets in advance, and they were falling on hard times. People weren't buying the tickets any longer. They weren't coming out to watch them perform. And this sort of bugged some of them. And one night in a small town, the minstrels were about to go on. They had sold the tickets, but they didn't sell very many. It was getting cold and snowy outside, and so they all had a little meeting before their performance that night. And one guy said, "Look, I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm tired of performing for such measly audiences. Ticket sales have gone down. Not many people are willing to come out anymore. They don't want to spend the money. Besides that, it's starting to snow outside, and I don't think many people are going to come out tonight. Let's just call it off." Went around, and some of them said, "You know, I agree. We have traveled long, and we've worked hard, and it's just not the same anymore." All of the heads turned toward an older gentleman who was sort of like the coach for this band of minstrels. He said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what I think. I think we took money from them. I think we owe them a good performance. I think we ought to do our very best and perform our hearts out for these people. It doesn't matter who's not coming. It matters who's here." They said, "Well, okay." And he sort of rallied them together, encouraged them, and they all went out. And that night, they performed their absolute best. It was the best thing they had done in months. It was a job well done, and they felt good about it. But what really got them excited is afterwards, that older gentleman came with trembling hands. He had a little note in it. He said, "Listen to this, guys." It was a simple note. It just said, "Thank you for a wonderful performance tonight, signed, Your King." In that little village, unbeknownst to anybody else, the king of that country had slipped in and watched them perform. And they were so excited that they did it with all of their heart because their king was watching them. And I think that's how we ought to work in the professional realm. Our king is watching us. It doesn't matter who else is. "Thank you for a wonderful performance, signed, Your King." That's Paul's idea here. Do it as unto Christ, not as unto men. And that's what Daniel did. Now, Daniel was not a priest. He was not an evangelist. He was not a minister. He didn't preach to thousands of people. He didn't have a healing line. He was a businessman in a secular kingdom. And yet he did more to affect Babylon with a witness of God's glory and goodness than anybody else, though he was in the professional secular realm, a businessman. I think we ought to have the same attitude that the housewife had, who had a plaque above her stove and sink that said, "Divine service is rendered here 3 times daily. Isn't that great? She says, "I see my job as a housewife as divine service. When I cook a meal for my family, I'm doing it as unto the Lord. It's divine service." That was Daniel's attitude. Let's look back at Daniel and see a third way that he was faithful. Faithful consistently, faithful professionally, but thirdly, he was faithful when he was put under the microscope of scrutiny, when they examined his life closely. In verse 4, "So the governors and the satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him." Jealousy is brewing in the hearts of his colleagues. Why? Because it says the king wanted to put him, and here's the key word, above them. And anytime somebody is blessed more than we are, or if we get to a prominent position, we're going to get scrutiny. We're going to get criticism. And Daniel's colleagues are experiencing that jealousy. Romans chapter 12 tells the Christian, "Rejoice with those that rejoice. Weep with those that weep." You know, I found it's much easier to do the second part of that commandment than the first. It's easy to weep with those that weep. Somebody's having hard times, we put our arms around them, we weep with them, but what about when somebody's being blessed more than we are? It's harder to rejoice with them. Maybe we have needs ourselves that aren't being met, and somebody else gets their needs met exceedingly abundantly above all that they could ask or think. and they come to tell us about it. Oh, brother, I just got a brand new car, God bless me with, and a brand new job. And we go, oh, praise God. I'm so excited. It's sometimes more difficult to rejoice with those that rejoice than it is to weep with those that weep. And Daniel's buds who work with him didn't like Daniel being raised higher than they were being raised. And so they reacted under this. But under close scrutiny even, Daniel stood the test in his private life as well as his public life. Now let me read verse 4 to you in another version. The Jerusalem version of the Bible translates it this way. They could find nothing to discredit him and no case of negligence. He was so punctilious that they could not find a single instance of maladministration or neglect. What a translation that is. He was flawless under scrutiny. They saw that he was faithful, but they thought, let's just examine him closely. Couldn't find a thing against him. It's as if Daniel was following a New Testament piece of advice. Peter wrote these words in 1 Peter chapter 2. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day that he visits us. Now, let me just share for a minute that we're in a great setting that speaks, I think, of the faithfulness of a man, Billy Graham. And I'm not just saying this because this is his conference center. But Billy Graham, his name, now as you know, televangelists are scrutinized to the max. And people are always looking for trash to spread around. But they can't find it on Billy Graham. In fact, the Gallup poll's most admired men in the world, the top 10 most admired men, in the last 27 years, Billy Graham has been in that list 26 times. That is a testimony of a man who, under scrutiny, has been found faithful. Daniel was like Billy Graham in the Old Testament. He was on the top 10 list year after year. Finally, we'll close with this. Fourthly, he was faithful spiritually. He was faithful spiritually. Verse 6. The governors and satraps thronged before the king and said, King Darius, live forever. They're buttering him up, basically. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators, the satraps, the counselors, the advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into a den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the decree. When Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he knew that his fate was sealed, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since the early days. And these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Daniel was at a major crossroads. The law had been passed. He knew about it. He knew that it was now illegal to pray to any other god except the king of Babylon, the king of the Medes and the Persians. Now, what did he do? Well, he could have thought, first of all, and he could have rationalized, could have come up with a number of options. He could have said, okay, it's only 30 days. What's 30 days? I can lay low for a month. I mean, I can take my prayer life and put it in a holding pattern for 30 days. I'll be back, God. After all, religion is a private thing. I don't want to cause any kind of a stir or an outfall in my department among my colleagues, so I'll just keep it low for 30 days. Or he could have said, well, I'll pray, but I'll pray in secret. I'll take a walk around those 60-mile walls way far away from everybody else, and I'll just have my quiet time on my own, but I won't make a big stir about my God. Instead, what does Daniel do? He goes home, he opens his windows toward Jerusalem. It was always the Jewish way of saying, I hope we get back to Jerusalem one day where the temple once stood. We anticipate that God will bring us home. And 3 times a day he did this in front of everybody. You could say, oh, well, how ostentatious. What is he doing, rubbing his righteousness in their noses? No. It says, as was his custom from early days. Daniel is not doing anything different than he did when he was young or middle-aged. He's not all of a sudden getting righteous and all of a sudden becoming spiritual because he's in a jam. He always did this. It was a custom since he was young, and he is simply again being consistent, but in a spiritual manner. He's praying. Now, a lot of people do pray only in crisis situations. For many people, God is like a spiritual emergency room. They figure God's on call, and I don't need to be consistent with God. I don't need to have daily time spent with God. I don't need to read my Bible much, but I know where God is, and since God is a God of grace, I'll just give him a buzz when I'm in a jam. Calling Dr. God, I need you quickly, God. It's called a foxhole religion, where God is only called upon in times of a crisis. I heard about an irreligious soldier who was in a battlefield and bombs and bullets were going off all around him, and he jumped into a foxhole and there was a priest with a crucifix next to him, and this non-religious guy picks up the crucifix and said, please tell me, how do you use one of these things? I need to use it right now. He'd never had any thoughts of God until that moment. Not Daniel. He had done it since he was young. He opened his windows toward Jerusalem and he prayed, and he did it 3 times a day. Do you have a place where you regularly meet with God? A place that is kept holy, but it's just between you and God. It's a time where you express yourself and you let God's thoughts come in and fill your heart, where you're regularly meeting with him and talking things over. You say, well, I call on God when I need him. When don't you need him? We always need him. And I think the key to Daniel's life is he realized, I always need him. Thus, he had carved out each day a regular time and place that he had with God. This is really where faithfulness begins. Back to that verse in chapter 1. Daniel purposed in his heart. It was that commitment made at a young age, probably that he made at a younger age when he was with his parents in Jerusalem, that carried itself into Babylon and through every kingdom that came after Nebuchadnezzar. It's all related to our commitment to God. Is God your master passion? Jesus said, no man can serve two masters. He will love one and he will hate the other. He will hold the one and he will despise the other. John White has written many books. He is a physician from Canada. He wrote a book called The Fight. It's an excellent book about the balanced Christian life. And one of the excerpts from that book goes like this. It is precisely here where many Christians fail, attracted by money, by pleasure, by career, by position or prestige. They try to close their eyes to the fact that human nature makes it impossible for us to have more than one supreme goal in life. Ask what their supreme goal is, and they say, to glorify God, to serve Christ. But watch their lives, and you'll be puzzled. Talk to them, and you'll find a strange lack of excitement about the glory of God. You'll also find little evidence of vital faith. Most of my Christian physician colleagues are doctors first, and Christians second. They would be reluctant to admit this, and they might accuse me of being judgmental. Nevertheless, it is a fact not peculiar to physicians, but also true of Christian lawyers, Christian teachers, and others. The unnecessary weight does not have to be a career goal, however. It can be almost anything, trivial or important. Christian mother, what are you? Christ's follower who is called to do a good job of mothering, or a mother who is also a Christian? When Satan comes to you and says, back off on your Christian stand and I will not hurt your child, what do you do? Christ called us inflexibly and uncompromisingly to one loyalty. Unless you can identify and ditch competing goals and loyalties, you will never be a man or woman of faith. What a great legacy Daniel left. Faithful consistently, faithful professionally, faithful under scrutiny, and faithful spiritually in a commitment of heart. Alexander the Great, you know his story, most of you. He conquered the world, and at 31 years old, he sat down in Babylon and wept because there was no more worlds that he knew about to conquer. It is said that he was so aggressive that he came to a walled city at one time with a small band of soldiers. He demanded to see the king of the city. The king marched out. The people were around him. And Alexander the Great said, "I demand that you surrender your city." The king laughed. Looking at the small amount of troops that Alexander had and the great group that he had behind him, he laughed and he said, "Why should I surrender to you? What can you do to me?" Alexander said, "Let me demonstrate." He lined up his men in single file and marched them toward a cliff. One after one walked off of a cliff and fell to their death. 10 of them died until Alexander finally said, "Enough." Then he turned back to the king and he said, "Again, I demand your surrender." The king and all the people knew that they could not withstand people who had that kind of a commitment because they knew that there were more where they came from. They knew that eventually Alexander would win, and they surrendered the city on Alexander's terms because they saw in his men a level of loyalty, commitment, and faithfulness they had not seen anywhere else. So again, the question, most will proclaim each his own goodness, but who can find a faithful man? Oh, would to God that among us we would say, "I will be that man, I will be that woman, I will be faithful, God. You have given me this position in life for your glory to spread your word around the world." Let's pray. Father, we are thankful for the time that we have spent, and what a privilege it is to examine such a good example, a man who lived his life from the beginning years to the latter, the twilight years, as one who is a good example of keeping a promise, of being faithful, not only publicly, but also privately. So, Lord, I pray that you would help us, each of us, Lord, as you examine us this week, to be your ambassadors in this world, that we would be faithful in a consistent manner, that we would be faithful in our professional lives, that we would be faithful when people watch us closely and examine what we say and what we do and what motivates us. And Lord, that it would all begin by being faithful spiritually, sold out and surrendered to you. That we would be a Christian first and everything else second. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.